Thank you, Robertson.
Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
You confirm your full name to be Hugh Robertson?
Hugh Alistair Robertson.
Hugh Alistair Robertson. And you confirm you hold a doctorate in wetland ecology and a Bachelor of Science honours?
That's correct.
And you compare the evidence dated the 28th of July?
That's correct.
And you participated in an expert conference on wetlands on the 30th of August?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
Perhaps the only other thing to note is I also attended the GIS expert conferencing, not as an expert for that conferencing, but just to provide some further content which was utilised by those who were participating.
Yes, thank you. And so do you confirm the evidence to be true and correct to the best of your belief and knowledge?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I just have some examination material questions too.
Thank you.
So you would have been, I know you haven't been online last week, but you have been reading the transcripts that have come out, and so you'll be aware that there's been discussion around, of course, the setbacks, but in particular for wetlands where the 10-metre setback that the Director General is seeking would start. Are you able to give any explanation or context around, in your expert opinion, how you would measure that distance?
Certainly, and also just for the court, just let me know if I'm speaking too fast or not loudly enough, and for those in other parts of the room as well. So I think it's good just to start with the wetland definition topic that has come up with a range of different council and different experts. During the wetland expert conferencing and joint witness stand, we confirmed, to the best of our knowledge, that the definition of wetlands being applied in PC1 is associated with the definition of the Waikato Regional Plan, which is the RMA definition of wetlands. Now that's a fairly open-ended definition of wetlands, the RMA definition. It includes, for example, areas of open water. And so there we also discussed in the wetlands joint expert conferencing, and we had some late experts just for this question, is the boundary between wetlands and lakes is important within the context of PC1, because you can have open bodies of water and you may have a particular person who interprets it, well, that's a wetland in this context, or no, that's a lake in this context. So what was proposed, and I think has the Waikato Regional Council has a schedule or a list of lakes, and those are lake systems which are over 1 hectare in size. Now, therefore, areas of open water that are less than that size, in my view, can be defined as a wetland. They are often also containing aquatic plants and wetland plants as well. So I guess I'm dealing with the inland boundary issue, I guess the wet boundary issue with wetlands and lakes, and I'll get to the setbacks part of it soon. But I just felt that that was important clarification that if different provisions such as setbacks are applied to lakes, that the defining of a lake is important because it does overlap with wetlands in terms of an ecotone. Where the proposed 10-metre setbacks for wetlands will start, identifying the boundary of a wetland is also going to be critical for implementation on the ground. This is an issue that many councils are dealing with the NPS Freshwater 2020 regulations that have come out with more requirements around wetlands. And they have provided wetland delineation tools that go into three different components. There, it starts with a vegetation component, whether or not the wetland supports wetland plants or not. Following on that, there's a soils component, whether or not the area of land has hydric soils or soils that are influenced by wetland processes. And thirdly, it has a hydrological assessment to it as well. So there are three ways to confirm when you're walking in a wetland towards a hill, where exactly is the edge of that wetland going to be? And the people that developed these tools did exactly that. They started in a very much a wetland, and then they walked away towards a hill slope into an area that was drier, and could use these tools to define exactly where the edge would be. Often you only need to use them where it's actually an area of contention. When you walk around in lots of different wetland landscapes, it's quite clear where the wetland is starting and stopping from a change in elevation. So the tools will not have to be applied everywhere. They won't be onerous in that sense that you need experts to be out in the landscape doing it everywhere. That is not my expectation. But they are very useful where there are areas of disagreement about where a wetland edge is and therefore where the setback needs to start to put. So it's perhaps a long answer, but I hope that is useful.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Mike, can I just ask what I think may be a follow-on matter and ask where it fits in? Dr. Robertson, where in all of that, to what extent should we be looking at the definition of a natural inland wetland in the national policy space? And in particular, the exceptions that are in that definition?
It's a good question, I think, that the court should consider. At the moment, as I understand, the exceptions, for example, include pastoral wetlands.
The main one, it appears, I mean, there's geothermal coastal marine area, I don't know that we're getting into that, but it's the wetland that's within an area of pasture used for grazing, vegetation cover, more than 50% exotic pasture, according to a methodology, unless the wetland's part of a habitat of threatened species.
I thought about this a little bit, and in my view, it comes to the purpose of PC1 around protection and restoration. When you look at a pasture wetland where it's dominated by more than 50% pasture species, and so this is a recognition that in the landscape you can have wetland soils, for example, it's got some water maybe at or near the soil surface, but it may be, in terms of what is currently there, 20% dominated by some rushes of some sort, and the rest has been farmed for a prolonged period of time. And so therefore, a boundary, MFE defined a boundary of this threshold of a pasture wetland that is now being applied. And I don't see that at the moment being linked into PC1. I haven't seen that in any of the planning documents.
No, it hasn't been put in. I suppose the question is, given that PC1 has to give effect to the NPSFM as well as any other relevant national policy statement, to what extent could it be or should it be linked? And I know there's two limbs of that. One is, if you like, the legal or planning side of it, and the other would be the scientific side.
My comment would be, in the restoration realm, is that those systems that, let's say, are dominated by a pasture species of 60%, it's a one-off assessment on a particular year, that if you are then not enabling the protection to those places, going to be more difficult to actually enable wetland restoration, because in a sense that you're walking away a little bit from those pasture wetlands in a restoration sense. Mm. And so therefore it comes to the overall objectives that you're trying to seek for wetland ecosystems, and whether or not you're wanting to maintain those in a, enable more restoration of those around them that are sort of have some level of degradation in terms of their dominance of pasture. And when I was involved with some of the MFE discussions within my capacity and my job, I personally thought it was a little low as a threshold. And I was suggesting to colleagues that it may be 60% would be more appropriate because of this degraded state of many of our wetland systems. That's technically general advice.
Thank you, Mr. Mike.
Thank you, sir. So Dr. Robinson, whilst I was presenting legal submissions, I referred to some evidence of laws regarding 9% of wetlands in Waikato. Are you able to expand on that, please?
Certainly. I think Your Honour was interested in this 9% figure yesterday as well.
Yes. I tracked that back to your statement, and the main point I had, Doctor, was what was the baseline for that? Because presumably there have been changes in the extent of wetlands over time, and I didn't know whether that's sort of 9% ever or 9% of what had been measured 50 years ago or 20 years ago or last year or when.
Certainly. So the 9% figure relates to the Waikato biogeographic region. So there was New Zealand was split into a range of bioregions, and there's the one for the Waikato, which is separate from the one from the Coromandel, for example. So the 9% figure that relates to all wetlands, and these are palustrine wetlands, so they're bogs and fens and swamps and marshes and some other wetland types. That remain as of that report was published in 2008. So, and that did utilise some older data sets as well. So data sets post 2000, but obviously before 2008. The baseline or the reference which they were comparing to the historic extent for the whole of that Waikato bioregion was a modelled extent based on soil types and also utilising elevation in terms of looking at slope. So flatter areas with the wetland soils were then mapped as being historic wetlands. And that's how they did the calculation based on that basis. For the Waikato Regional Council Authorities area, it's slightly lower. It's around 8% for the region.
So it's an assessed baseline using evidence of soil type and topography.
And so, Dr. Robinson, there has also been a lot of discussion around practicalities and costs of fencing wetlands, particularly the 50 metre square versus the 500 metre square. Do you have any comment on that, around what an appropriate size should be?
Yes, small wetlands has certainly been discussed. I've read the transcript from when I wasn't at the proceedings last week when it was mentioned and been present yesterday and today. The 50 metres squared, as I think was confirmed yesterday, came from the decisions version, and I was present at the hearings, and I recall the commissioners asking our opinion on what is a minimum size of wetlands that the setback provisions should apply to. I don't think I gave a specific number during that hearing, which maybe did not help then. But I did, however, try to present some evidence or information to provide context. So the 500 metre squared recommendation, or I guess it's a requirement within the regulations, is a New Zealand-wide perspective on the applicability, the appropriateness to achieve benefits for wetland systems across all of New Zealand, including areas such as the West Coast, or even in the TIR Basin region, where actually the extent of wetlands is much higher than what is within the Waikato region. So I think there's some 25% of wetlands remaining in the West Coast region, for example, compared to the 8 or 9% that is left in the Waikato. So there is a context of actually getting the representation of biodiversity, maintaining and conserving and protecting the biodiversity of a bioregion of New Zealand, which has lost a lot of its wetland systems. And with those 8% or so wetlands remaining here, when you actually break it down to specific wetland types, that report concludes that, for example, fens, which there used to be 20,000 hectares predicted, is less than 1% of that wetland type remaining, because the 8% figure is a higher level. We have some rare wetland types, and these fen systems are often associated with more close to the hill slopes, where there's both groundwater and surface water contributions to their hydrology. So, in my view, for also because of the, because of the depletion of wetland systems within the Waikato region, that actually considering what is needed to actually achieve the objectives of PC1 is really critical. We have also threatened species such as Australasian bittern or Matuku, which is relatively good numbers in the Waikato region and in places like Northland compared to down south. They rely on a network of wetland habitats. Research has found they often can move 50 or 60 kilometres searching for different food resources. So we have threatened species that are moving across the landscape. Research also published by Landcare Research looking at plant communities in New Zealand looked at the aspect of wetland size and preserving threatened plants in New Zealand. And they found there's no influence of wetland size on the diversity of wetland threatened plants. In other words, our large wetlands were not necessarily that much better than the small ones at actually having a diversity of threatened plants. This is because there are rare systems now, we've lost so many of them, that you also find rare species associated with those. I guess what I'm trying to present is that there is a wetland loss challenge, and small wetlands have a critical role in biodiversity. They also have a critical role in, as being critical source areas if they are poorly managed, in my view, as well. Around New Zealand, constructed wetlands have been increasingly used to actually deal with contaminants going down into downstream waterways. And so we're seeking to, in work by NIWA has identified that we need to maintain a percentage of our wetlands in the landscape to look after our river systems and our estuarine systems because of the role they have in attenuating nutrients and sediment. So these small wetland systems, as well as having a biodiversity benefit, have also a functional purpose in trapping sediments and trapping nutrients. But if they are poorly managed, as in there's not very, the setbacks are not efficient in actually dealing with sediments and contaminants before they come into those small wetlands, they actually lose their ability to catch a sediment and nutrients over time.
They lose the ability to function.
That's right. Again, maybe I haven't answered your question directly, but I'm just providing, I guess, a context for why the significance of these small woodland systems. What I'll just reflect on is the 3 metres versus 10 metres as well proposed, because some, I think, other parties or experts have suggested that you may get things like weed encroachment or it becomes more difficult to manage these things if you actually have fences around them. Well, at 3 metres, the information that I have seen from the work of Fenimore and Sarasini identifies a suggestion of a 10-metre setback, but the ability for these setbacks at lower levels to effectively reduce contaminants is not as clear. So if we had small setbacks around our small wetlands, for me, these systems will be more likely to have less ability to actually attenuate the nutrients going, sediment going into them. In addition, because of that, we're more likely to get exotic plant species as well, because there's a relationship between increased contamination and degradation. So in my view, you also need effective setbacks for effective weed management, as well as management of the contaminants.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. I'm just needing to also just ask some questions around the table 3.7.7 in the regional plan. The point there being that the 10 metres in the post-conferencing version of PC1 is intended to only apply to those wetlands in that table. Do you have any comments around that approach?
Yeah, from a technical perspective, we're in through the wetland expert conference, and it's, I think, noted in the joint witness statement that we agree that there is evidence supporting the 10-metre setbacks being applied to the wetland systems listed in Table 3.7.7 of the regional plan. However, then, in my view, I do not see the rationale for having a smaller setback from a technical perspective if you try and protect other wetlands. So, there is evidence supporting the 10-metre setback as being an appropriate size for managing contaminants going into waterways. certainly strongly support the recommendations for Table 3.7.7. But if Policy 17, as I understand, is aiming to reduce contaminants from all wetland systems, so why does the technical basis for establishing 10 metres for the one system map table not apply to the other wetlands? And I don't have a clear reason for that.
You don't have any ecological reason for that?
In a way, the smaller wetlands are actually more susceptible to contamination than the significant ones listed on that table, because the size of a wetland, in a sense, it's going to be more vulnerable from contaminants coming into it versus a large system, let's say, of 500 hectares in size. You have an edge effect where the centre of it is becoming more protected. So I would actually consider that it's just the small wetlands that require that the 10 metres setbacks more than the size.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. So, have you got any thoughts around views on how, in terms of managing the wetlands, whether they could be prioritised in any way, or is your response as per your previous answers that they're all equally important?
I think this comes to the aspect of feasibility. There are 15,000 hectares of wetlands mapped by the FEMS database of wetland systems within the PC1 area. Of those, 41%, I think, is within land managed by the Department of Conservation. So there's obviously a range of wetland systems not within conservation areas. And they would have to have some fencing requirements, including small wetland systems. It's recognised there's a significant amount of work required to fence these wetland systems, but they're also of critical value and very highly threatened. Prioritising those that are the greatest level of vulnerability from different land management practices would make sense. And so you can, through a farm and climate plan process, I guess, if you have 20 or 30 different wetland systems in a landscape to fence or to establish management of, to have a phased approach to implementing the regulations.
Thank you. And just one final question around the whānau marama wetlands. You've had some intimate involvement in the recent events that have occurred there. You've noted that in your evidence, but is there anything else you want to comment on in light of last week's hearing and the issues that have come up?
Still, I think it's been well stated in my evidence about the more recent anoxic and blackwater events that occurred in the summer of 2022-23. I visited and undertook fieldwork myself during that time. I guess the one thing that maybe isn't written in my evidence, it's more of a just observation when I was there, was just the quietness of the wetland. And so it's hard to, in a very formal hearing such as this, to be in a landscape that has had a lot of algal deposition, the dissolved oxygen levels were very, very low, that you were just in a landscape that there was no movement of invertebrates, there was no movement of birds, there's no movement of fish. It was a very, you almost like a very, very peaceful place, but it was actually devoid of life on the particular day that we were out there in the field. So I guess it's just to recognise it was for me, I've been around a lot of wetland systems in New Zealand and a lot of wetland systems internationally, and it was one that really shook me on that particular day. And it just struck me about the urgency of action that is needed to address the high level of contamination of that wetland. And then I read PC1 and I look at the implementation methods, and there doesn't seem to be much there that is addressing the urgency of the situation.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. Please remain and answer any questions.
Sir, I have one question.
Oh, here we go. Thank you. It's a long way.
Good afternoon, Dr. Robertson. What I wanted to ask you about was the comments that Dr. Simon Stewart's evidence about the recent report, Mrs. Paradise 2730 of his evidence, the recent report by the Ministry for the Environment on the Ashburton Lake, and the ongoing nutrient enrichment concerns in those lakes, even though they have FEPs that have been audited. And I understand that with wetlands, similarly to lakes, we have to manage nutrient loads because, of course, nutrients don't flush through like with
with river systems. And I wanted to ask you whether there's the same risk with locking in, if you like, nutrient loads through freshwater environment feeds in the wetland catchments, and whether you consider that the narrative wetland states that you proposed at page 32 of your evidence might assist with that issue. Do you understand the question?
I think I do. Shall I think I'll just go to his evidence first, because I if you just refer to that paragraph.
Yes, so that's paragraph 27 of Dr. Stewart's evidence, which is at 320.0592, where he talks about the Ashford and Lakes report.
What's the 320 again?
320.0592. 0592.
I'm just looking at the zip file on my screen to see if I can.
Well, I have a clean copy that I can provide.
Just repeat your question.
Is there a similar risk as with lake subcatchments, with the wetland subcatchments, that audited FEPs may not be sufficient to manage nutrient loads coming into those wetlands? And the second part of that question was, would your narrative wetland states assist with that risk at all?
Thank you. I've been personally connected with the Ashford and Lakes for 10 years as part of my role, and looking at the lake and wetland systems down there as well. So I'm quite aware of the MFE report, the lessons learned report, looking at freshwater regulations over time in the state of the lakes. And there's, in that landscape, there are four large farms, large sheep stations previously, and now becoming more intensive in their land use. The increased amount of cattle and dairy support going up into the Ashburton Basin. And there's been a 15-year deterioration in the condition of those lakes. And there have been an application of the Farm Environment Plan tool. And certainly was never really aware of what the details of those Farm Environment Plans were, but we've been sort of separate from it. But there certainly has been recognition that they haven't been effective in a sense reducing the level of nitrates, for example, going into those lake systems. There are some properties where, even though the Farm Environment Plans have been in place, and the lakes have had a poor status for a few years, or even a decade, that the nitrate levels and some of those monitored streams have continued to go up, even with the Farm Environment Plans being in place. So I guess that's the answer to your first question, is that I think it is a concern that if you don't get the details of those Farm Environment Plans correct, you won't necessarily see the outcomes that you are aiming to achieve. In terms of narrative wetland attributes, which I've described in my evidence, I do believe they will be of value in developing farm environment plans for the PC one. The reason for that is when you are undertaking an assessment of, let's say, sensitive water bodies on a property, and you may have a wetland system on an aspect of your property, what are you trying to do for that wetland? And who gets to determine that? You're trying to reduce contaminants to a wetland system, but what if it's a pristine wetland system? You know, who gets to figure that out? So for for me, I feel like direction is needed so that those undertaking environment plans have to ask themselves the question, do we need to restore that wetland back to some healthier state over a time frame, or are we trying to look after it because it seems like whatever contaminants going into it are not a concern. And there's no direction of how to undertake an assessment of a sensitive water body and whether or not it's meeting its outcome. So I think defining a narrative of the outcome is very valuable in descriptive terms for effective planning.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Dr. Robertson. Just sticking with the Ashburton example momentarily, if you don't mind, just looking, have you still got, Dr. Stewart, Dr. Demotion, say Dr. Stewart for safety. His evidence in front of you on page 10, have you got that there, sir?
I think I've got
it's the same part that you were referred to before.
Yes, sir.
And you'll see there, paragraph 28 refers to two important findings from the report. Now, I'm not professing to understand more about that report than what's stated here. I'm conscious you may be in a similar position, but you'll see the second of those important findings at the top of page 10 says, in that case, I think it means the FEP system is overly focused on process rather than environmental outcomes. You'll see it says that there.
Yes.
And so, at least at the level of principle, an FEP system that was focused on outcomes, not just process, you could say that learned from that Ashburton example and was an improvement on it. That'd be a fair comment?
Yes, that would be fair.
Have you got a copy of the provisions, the post-conferencing provisions for this plan change?
I've got a Word document that was circulated, I think, is...
If it's worth it, I'm sure that's fine, yes.
I think the post-conferencing version of PC1.
Yes, thank you. Could you turn to Schedule D1, which is on page 42 of my version, that may well be different from what you've got there. Let's try it to start with.
Yes, I've got it.
And part B, so this is the requirements for a farm environment plan for farming as a permitted activity. And part B is the farm environment purpose, which has four limbs there, which I'll let you read rather than me reading them out, if you could just refresh your memory on those.
So this is the one I'm talking about to achieve states in Table 3, Level 1, is that part?
Yes, and give effect to the requirements for crucial farm plans. Demonstrate general improvement, reduce diffuse discharges, and demonstrate compliance with minimum standards. Okay.
Yes, I can see that. I guess I don't see the reference to wetland systems specifically, but I can see the references in front of me.
Yes. So while it's difficult perhaps to compare this with what the FEP system in Ashburton was, you would see that those are, that part B sets out a clear purpose for EPPs under PC1.
A fair purpose? I think it's clear for those that have target states defined in Table 3, Level 1. Those are, for example, subcatchment targets, and there are some lake ones defined as well. The farming on wetland also has specific nitrogen and phosphorus outcomes. But for other wetland systems, I guess, it may not be fair for those.
The point I was endeavouring to get at was that is it clear in there, in terms of those four purposes, that there is a purpose for FEPs here, and it's hard to know whether that's better or worse than what the Ashburton scenario was, but based on that comment that we've just had a look at in Dr. Stewart's evidence, it appears it's probably better. I think that would be a fair statement from based on what we can see on the page.
It's made some improvements, yes.
Yeah. In terms of the question of targets for wetlands. My friend talked to you briefly about a healthy range, I think, your recommended narrative target attribute state for wetland ecosystems. You're aware, I take it, that council is still completing its inventory of wetlands required by the NPCD, and that'll be a long inventory, won't it? With quite a wide range of wetland types and states.
There's inventory for mapping, and then there's information needed to set targets, which are probably two different things, because you have a sampling approach that you can apply for the targets when the mapping is required under the MFA regulations.
Yes. In terms of the targets and how they might compare to current state, would you expect there's going to be a wide range of current states in Waikato region and these catchments we're talking about here?
The handbook for wetland condition monitoring was published a while ago. It was an MFE document as well, led by Bev Clarkson from Landcare Research. And I guess my answer is yes. Utilising those kind of tools, the wetland condition assessment approach, which can use both descriptive ways of measuring the status of a wetland and are also more data informed approaches, that based on my knowledge of the wetlands of the Waikato PC1 region, there will be a range of highly degraded wetland systems to those that are closer to regular condition.
Yes, and that's not information we have clarity on at this point, but it's getting there. Yes. And would you agree that knowing the current state, the baseline state for those wetlands, is an important part of understanding how much work it's going to take to get each wetland from where it is now to where we'd ideally like it to be?
In the context of the scope of Plan Change 1, which is focused on contaminants, because we're not, I think if you look at a wetland system or everything that's needed in terms of investment to actually restore it to its full function, there are other things that will take a significant amount of work. But for the purposes of PC1, it's about identifying when you need, in my view, to maintain the level of contaminants because they're acceptable versus reduce the level of contaminants. And so it's the ability to make an assessment on how we therefore you need to manage those sensitive water bodies and critical source areas, utilising the provisions that are already established within the schedules. So it's just to see how you do that, how you apply the schedules when you haven't identified a target. So I don't think you need an extensive amount of baseline information to make those assessments. You can actually do it as part of site visits.
In terms of what you've just said, the level of intervention required if you are simply trying to maintain current state versus if you're trying to improve it could be quite different for the landowner, couldn't they? And so to understand how much you're asking of the landowner, it would be helpful, certainly from their perspective, to understand how much improvement would be required.
And I see that in line with determining, you know, to what extent are sensitive water bodies within, you know, downstream environments, which are sort of outlined within the provisions. So you need some way to figure out to what degree they're sensitive. And so a tool such as having a narrative target, I think, would be a piece.
In terms of the target that you've outlined, I take it you would have read Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence, and his view is that the term or the phrase healthy range for the specified wetland type is not well defined and it's likely to create confusion. Do you agree with that statement or do you disagree with it?
We covered that specifically in the joint witness statement. I think I could probably be best to read it. I'll start if you don't mind.
Yes, thank you for question 12.
Thank you. in the matters of agreement under that question, we agreed that not defining that term healthy range is likely to create confusion, as would the absence of having the attributes as well. So there's two aspects there. Will there be a need, or there is a need for guidance on how to give effect to process 17 and how individual farm plans determine whether wetlands on the property or downstream are degraded or not, and require specific actions. There's agreement on that as well.
Yes, and to be clear, the previous page shows that there was agreement that having numerical targets based on the monitoring would be ideal, but that's not a possibility at this point in time.
That was for numerical, certainly.
Yes.
But for narrative, that's a separate question. So for a narrative target, there will need to be guidance on what a healthy range is, I agree. And there are resources available, such as the description of physical and chemical deterioration in the handbook for monitoring wetland condition. That aren't then needing monitoring data to inform those expert assessments.
So do I take it from that then that you're saying the healthy range could be defined by either numeric characteristics that we had them or some other descriptors?
That's correct.
Because in terms of Dr. Scarsbrook's view, he was clear that healthy range, from his perspective, is essentially a numeric attribute state where the numbers are undefined, because you have to work out what healthy range means in some real world sense in order to understand whether you're in the healthy range.
Yes, and I saw the transcript as well when Dr. Scarsbrook was talking about because in a sense what I'm proposing is a healthy range, it therefore has numeric aspects to it. But also the NPS, freshwater management, requires that attributes are measurable. So even a narrative target has to be measurable. So therefore, the way I've written it as a healthy range is purposely written in a way that is a measurable attribute. You can see that only in numeric terms, as we need a number of total nitrogen levels in swamps that recognise it as good condition. We've got that, for example, for Palmerino. But you also, I think, have a measurable quality that is written in descriptive terms initially, while the other information is being gathered, to then turn it into a narrative measure in time.
So at this point, if the plan just said healthy range, it's not getting you far enough down the track, though, is it?
Hence the need for guidance. And so I think to give effect to that in the plan, I guess for the benefit of the court, is I agree, as written, healthy range is too open and vague, but there are tools, and I wrote this in my evidence as well, there are ways for that healthy range to be provided in terms of guidance, which could then be utilised in a farm environment plan context.
Right, so you see that as potentially being done in a farm environment plan rather than in this plan chart.
This is where it goes into planning world, and I think how exactly that is probably outside of what I can provide sensible advice on.
So far we've been talking about, in large part, about how you measure these things. Switching to what you do about them, what you do with these wetlands. The presence or absence of target attribute stats in the plan essentially relates to measurement, to some extent relates to how much needs to be done. Would you accept that even if this additional target attribute state of healthy range is not in the plan, the measures that are in the plan, in terms of things like stock exclusion, are going to move the wetlands to which they, which are subject to those stock exclusion requirements, from where they are to a healthier range? In other words, the practical on-farm measures like stock exclusion are the things that are going to shift the dial.
It's quite explicit, the stock exclusion, the proposed stock exclusion around wetland systems. And so, yes, I agree, stock exclusion, if the 10 metres, for example, is in place around wetland systems, Act will provide the tool to achieve those, or to work towards that narrative target outcome. However, there are also other areas of contamination that can affect wetland systems. For example, I think I heard during questioning today, there are sometimes channelised watercourses or drainage systems, for example, that transport contaminants directly into wetlands. So if they're identified as a sensitive water body and in a degraded state, there may be additional things that the Farm Environment Plan needs to do, or should do, or if possible do, to actually achieve the outcome. So if you just rely on the setbacks without actually thinking, well, what else needs to be done, you may not address another critical source of contamination.
I understand the point you're making. The question is, what is done on farm to manage the risk of contaminants getting into the water bodies, isn't it? That's the, from a practical shifting the dial perspective, that's what's going to make the difference to these wetlands, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yes. And if those things are done, then whether or not there is something to measure it isn't going to reduce the amount of benefit that the wetland gets from those actual practical measures, is it?
It comes to the scale of intervention. Because if a system is a sensitive water body, and looking at the narrative state, oh, we actually think this is a fairly poor condition wetland, the level of intervention required in a farm environment plan may be different to one that's in a better condition. So you need some goalposts. When it comes to having goalposts for the level of investment required, and it also enables those farm environments where there's no real concern on the wetlands because they're in good condition.
In terms of the setbacks, do you accept the question there in terms of whether setbacks from wetlands and site exclusion applies to all wetlands or just wetlands above a particular size threshold, and what the setback is for particular wetlands? That has an ecological component in terms of the values that you're protecting. It also has a practical component for the farmer as to how much land requires exclusion and possibly how much land they spend on fencing and land that might be lost to productive capacity, isn't it? So your evidence is focused on the first part of that, on the ecological values. Turning to the Whangamurino wetland, you've described that and the evidence is very clear in terms of the event over this past summer, or alleged summer, some might say. And you would have heard or read at least Dr. Scarisbrook's description, which I understand you're already aware of anyway, in terms of the multi-party response to that event. His evidence was that given the many factors involved and the complexity of them, he would be very surprised if we could deal with all of them. In other words, all of the things that lead the Whangamurino wetland to be in the state it's in now. He'd be surprised if we could deal with all of those things in Plan Change 1, given Plan Change 1 is focused on 4 contaminants. Would you agree with that?
The primary drivers of the degradation of Whangamurino, there are, in most wetland systems of its size and scale and position in a landscape, there are always many drivers of degradation. From a wetlands, and there's a range of textbooks from around the world, that the primary driver of first level wetlands is its hydrological regime. But second after that comes water quality contamination, has also been the primary driver of the health of wetland systems. And recognising the scope of PC1 is on the contaminants, although I think there is some, I think the policy may have mentioned, you know, hydrological factors where they're influenced. I personally feel the implementation methods for lakes and wetlands lack any clear direction for giving effect to Objective 5 and 16. So, you know, clear, and I very much support that objective and that policy to give them the outstanding water body status of the Whanganui Marina. But when I look through then the other sections of the plan, it's good to have targets in place for Whanganui River Island Lock Road, which occurred through the hearing process. There's obviously going to be a range of interventions needed at all of the sub-catchments. But there doesn't seem to be any urgency from the regional plan, and I guess that's just my technical view of it. I mean, it's over to the court and planners to how to give most effect to an urgent situation affecting an outstanding water body. It doesn't need an improvement in water quality status, absolutely, as urgently as possible. And are there some ways to improve its hydrological regime for the benefit of its ecological and cultural values? I think so as well. And I guess my evidence proposes some additions to implementation methods to provide some more specific direction in the regional plan.
And then the question of the extent to which those are matters for this plan change as opposed to another one that would sit with someone else.
Well, my technical view of things that are urgent, and if you can provide that direction in this plan change, that would be for the benefit of achieving the Objective 5 and Policy 16. Of giving effect to it, I guess, as early as possible, as opposed to, for me, the time for waiting in the system is over.
Thank you, Dr. Collins. Thank you.
The Roof Authorities, Ryan, no questions? Mr. Pinnell, any questions for Dr. Collins? Thank you. Fonterra.
No questions, thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you for your thorough explanation at the beginning about the differences with wetlands and the different interpretations under the RMA and the NPS. It's a pretty technical kind of difference, isn't it? It's a technical area.
Yes. Where to put boundaries or where to classify, if that's what you mean?
Just classifying them.
Particularly when you have different provisions in a plan change that relate to different types of water bodies. If they're the same provision, less significance.
And I note your suggestion that a lot of this work could actually be done in the farm environment plan for a property. But that also is a pretty technical job, isn't it?
This is why particularly MFE has been trying to provide tools to enable a range of different advisors and to be able to provide advice for a range of regulations coming through that process.
And you've helpfully sort of walked through the basis of the tools that would apply, and that relates pretty strongly to the definitions that are used or the way that the definition works in the NPS, isn't it?
And to wetlands generally.
So for a farm, a large farm, such as Lock Hill, which is over 3,000 hectares, to identify on a 50 square metre basis what might be a wetland that would trigger one of the requirements in plan change one. That's a reasonably significant task, isn't it? From an expert's perspective.
It does depend on the landscape, but I think yes and no. Sometimes a fairly quick site visit can be utilised with someone who's very familiar with the way that wetlands move in a landscape to identify, you know, with the location and boundaries of those systems. And I don't necessarily think it's a huge amount of work to come up with something that would be considered acceptable to a compliance officer or consents person or whoever it is. I've been involved in a number of wetland mapping exercises, and you can actually fairly quickly get a handle on exactly where things are starting and stopping.
And have those exercises been undertaken on hill country stations, or are they being largely on flatter country?
It's been a mixture, actually. The hill country one I was connected with was the one in the Ashford Lakes area, actually, so that was Canterbury High Country. So, and we were on, you know, a variety of different altitudes looking at wetland systems.
And about how long did it take you on that property to be able to pinpoint where the wetlands would be?
Initially, we utilised aerial photographs as a starting point, and so that was actually a fairly straightforward exercise. And then we did ground truthing to go out and identify on the ground and make sure that our initial assessment was not too bad. So that was tens of thousands of hectares, and the length of time involved in the field might have been 3 or 4 days for the one.
Now that's not an exercise that you'd expect a certified farm environment planner to be able to do. That's an exercise for a qualified ecologist, isn't it?
I think the way that the wetland tools have been developed, there's an aspect of when you get into more contentious situations, that, you know, exactly when, if it's, you know, when the wetland starts and stops, there can be a need for someone who's able to look at a soil profile, for example. And looking at soil profiles is something that, you know, I think the farming community has to do quite frequently. So to interpret, you know, is that a hydric soil or not, looking at a soil profile, I would have to ask really about the level of expertise, I guess the comfort that those people involved have at looking at those kind of information.
And in that Canterbury example you were given, what were the areas that of wetland you were looking? Were you looking down at the 50 square metre level, or was it at a larger level?
I think we're dealing with all wetlands that we could perceive in that one, because we weren't trying to do it for the purposes of setbacks or anything like that. So we're just trying to develop the best wetland map we possibly could, and we're going into much, you know, finer levels of details and, you know, different types of plant communities and things. So it was a bit of a different exercise, but it gave me a sense for, I guess, what may be needed at a more simplistic, just whether it's a wetland, yes or no, which is a bit more straightforward than a detailed wetland map approach.
So, in your view, aerial mapping could identify a wetland down at a 50 square metre level?
Not always. It does depend on the nature of the surrounding landscape. And I do know that the council, following NPS FM requirements, is mapping, undertaking extensive mapping of wetlands, so there'll be a significant asset available in time as well.
Did I understand your responses previously to suggest that, in your view, what Plan Change 1 is trying to capture is not the grassland wetlands?
No, that wasn't what I was suggesting. I was just reflecting to the court's question from his Honour around the differences between the definition of a natural wetland under the NPS and what is happening in PC1.
So in your view, the pasture wetlands should be included in the 50 square metres.
I then commented about what the goals of PC1 are in terms of the restoration of the Waikato region's wetland systems. And so I think, given the status of wetlands in this region, that if you set the bar too low, the ability to restore some of our wetland systems will not be there in the future as much as it could be. So I think it needs careful consideration.
And that's likely to be an expert making that judgment. The other questions that I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Robertson, relate to the koi cup issue. So your evidence has recorded that there are a range of plant, animal and pests that are a concern for wetlands in the Waikato. And you'd agree that koi carp are one of those pest species?
It's recognised as a critical pest for the region.
And they do contribute to the level of contamination from sediment?
I didn't look specifically at koi carp in my evidence. And I note the comments from Ms. MacArthur previously when you asked those questions. The one area I'm most familiar with is the Fonga Marina wetland, where I've spent many hours, and it has koi carp present. In that environment, monitoring that's been undertaken indicates that in some years, when there has been 20,000 tonnes of sediment in 1 year coming from a particular subcatchment, and it was assessed of 16,000 tonnes of that sediment deposited in the Fonga Marina wetland. And yes, there are koi present in that environment, and they can get into banks and continue to destabilise, and therefore further sort of exacerbate the already occurring water quality challenges. So can koi carp contribute to water quality degradation by destabilising vegetation in their banks? Yes, they can. But in many subcatchments, we also have big loads of poor quality water coming into our wetlands, such as the Fonga Marina. So it has to be given in context between the challenges in terms of catchment management.
And I think my clients would agree with you that context is important. So the koi carp, while not being the biggest contributor, are a contributor and source of sediment contamination within the Fonga Marina.
In that particular system, I wouldn't call them as a source, because the sediment is coming from other sources.
Except where they're damaging the banks. So aren't they generating sediment when they're damaging the banks?
There will be some, but I don't know if there's been an assessment as to what quantity in terms of the bigger picture that I tried to present.
Are they breeding in the dock wetland?
I cannot answer that question, I'm sorry. I know they're definitely present, I do not know their reproductive status.
Does the department have a strategy for eradication of koi carp?
There has been and is investment it's been since 2018, I think. There was specific funding that came to the department to work with other authorities, including the council, on approaches to management of freshwater pests. And so one of those target species was caught. And so there is actually work underway.
So
I'm not intimately involved with that work, but I do know it's underway.
So that's within the Waikato?
I think it's a New Zealand level freshwater pest program, but there is a focus on the Waikato with regards to Koi.
So my question was, does the department have a strategy for reducing or eradicating koi carp within the wetlands that it has control of?
I'm not intimately involved in that program, like I suggested, but I do know that there is investment going into it.
But you're not aware of any specific strategy with targets for reduction?
I just repeat the same answer. Yeah, there's definitely work underway, but I'm not closely involved. I mean, they may have more information.
Thank you. Federated Farms, Mr. Matheson. Thank you. Good afternoon. Most of my questions have been answered just briefly. The MFA have a wetland delineation protocol. It's quite a long document, quite complicated. Yes?
I was looking at it just today, and there's an overarching document. Is that the one you mean, or there's actually, there's also, because there's different parts to it. So the overarching one, they've tried to be very clear on the stepped process.
So this is what I understand the protocol recommended by MFE. First question is the potential wetland habitat for threatened species. If it is, then you apply the wetland delineation protocol. Is that your understanding? So that's the first question you ask.
I can bring up the protocol.
Have you applied the wetland delineation protocol?
I am not involved in the delineation personally, but I have been very closely involved with discussions on specific tools. For example, I've sent draft versions of some of those documents for my colleagues.
Yeah. You mentioned the Canterbury example. How many times have you personally applied the wetland delineation protocol?
I applied parts of the wetland delineation protocol. One example, actually, not too long ago, there was a fast-track consenting process. When the COVID things were happening, you might remember the government brought in fast-track consenting processes. And within that, there were certain developments occurring in different parts of New Zealand, and they're applying the wetland delineation protocols. And so I would then have to examine the information that they were provided and make sure that it was being followed.
Sorry, the question was, how many times have you been out on site and applied the wetland delineation protocol?
They're relatively recent, so I haven't been involved in any wetland mapping since those ones have come out.
Okay.
But I have been applying them in the context of my role.
As a desktop assessment?
I wouldn't necessarily say it that way, but... Okay.
Have you ever applied the pasture exclusion test on a site?
Which one do you mean, the 50% threshold thing?
Yeah, the wetland, the rapid pasture test or the pasture exclusion test.
I've been involved with many plant surveys.
Yeah.
And so again, these protocols have not been published for that long.
Sorry, is that a yes or a no? Have you ever been out on site and applied this test or not?
Sure. Specifically, I have undertaken pasture assessments of wetlands, and I've been doing that as part of restoration projects, because I have had different objectives to see about the success of the restoration project. And it's applying the same methodologies, but for a different purpose, not for a pasture exclusion region.
Thank you. No further
questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Robson. There's been a number of questions about the Ashburton Lakes work that you did. That's a landscape that I happen to know very well. So that's a landscape where the wetlands occur within a context of a glaciated landscape. So there's humps and hollows and and plenty of sort of swale areas of moving which they can, that aren't readily developed. How applicable is that topographic context to the Waikato region where the driving force behind the landscape within which the wetlands occur is much more organic?
And riverine as well. Yeah. Certainly there are large red tussock swamp systems, stream systems, for example, on some of those glacial moraines of the Ashburton Basin, which are very different, of course, very different landscape from here in the Waikato. In saying that, however, there are also areas that have been developed, not in that perhaps as intensive with agriculture, and there are some small wetland systems, for example, with what we call ephemeral wetlands down there on Kewahoe. They're actually relatively small in scale. So they would be around 50 metres squared size, some of these kettle hole systems. Yeah. And they're recognised as having highly vulnerable plant species. The hydrology goes up and down with the different seasons. So there's a similarity in the sense that they have, even though it's a large glacial moraine system, that within the farming landscapes there are a small wetlands that are highly valued. Here, certainly, the richer organic soils, I guess, of the Waikato regions, and a lot of peatland areas, areas that have been drained. There's also some, you know, remnant wetland systems within this landscape. And so, when you're examining aerial photographs, I think you think parts of, you know, it's fairly hard, actually, in Ashburton Lake, to actually do mapping, because it's a very brown landscape, and to detect wetlands. I think the topography is fairly varied within the perhaps less so things like the Hauraki Plains is very different. But within the Waikato, Waipara regions, it's more varied, and therefore the locations of wetlands is a bit more predictable in terms of downslope areas. So of course that's a generalisation, but those would be my comments, I guess, on the similarities or differences.
Thank you. Now, reading through your evidence, I took advantage of the PDF reader. It tells me how many times you used particular words. So values, wetland values came up 35 times. So what are they? You mentioned the values of wetlands and ecosystem values, ecological values, natural values. I'm not a wetland ecologist. What are the values are important in a narrative sense?
There are a broad range of values. My personal expertise is in the ecosystem health values, or the biodiversity values, environmental ecological. And there are the values of wetlands for biodiversity firstly, right, intimately associated with, in terms of protecting the diversity of New Zealand's flora and fauna, and the diversity of the wetlands as well, and an ecosystem, so wetland diversity and the representation of our wetlands across the land. So there's values with regards to ecological values there, I guess I'll speak to. There are also values with regards to the ecosystem services values that wetlands or other landscapes can provide as well. And those can include things such as for food provision, for flood management, for water quality improvement, and so forth. So there's a range of values in the ecosystem services area. And there's also the values which I can't speak to, it's not my area of expertise, with regards to for Tangata Whenua. So I guess that's probably the way I would characterise the clarification of values. There was a lot of values, I guess, in early versions of PC1, I think it, sections of the plan that didn't get through the decisions version.
Michael, thank you. That teaches that for me. And another word which comes up a lot is restore. So what do you mean by restore? You've alerted us to the fact that only 9% of the wetlands were survive. So is how far does the word restoration go in your mind?
Is it restoring extent? Is it area? And then there's restoring ecosystem health values. So there's two aspects I think of when I think of restore. So the 9% figure is just around the extent. And this, I guess, comes back to if you're looking at, let's say, pastoral wetlands, and you want to actually maintain those wetland systems or restore, then that can be a critical area where restoration can occur to increase extent. They may not be adequately mapped. Their wetlands, you know, hanging on, in a sense. So it's a restoration of extent option, I think, the ability for PC1 to achieve, I think, will have great benefits for future generations. In terms of restoration of condition, that goes back, for example, like the Fong Marina system, where the level of contamination of that is extremely high, and it's well above the nitrogen and phosphorus targets that can maintain a healthy ecosystem. And so restoration there looks at dealing with contaminants, reducing them down to a level which enables the natural processes to occur, for plant species to recover, and for full food chain effects of having a healthy ecosystem benefit a range of biodiversity.
So, most of your evidence is about Fong Marina wetland. To learn about that. The in terms of the restoration of that, and you know, setting aside all of the different sort of cross pressures there are in terms of the way that you know, the management of that, what would be the top priority if you could have it to start to restore that wetland?
It's a good question. I'll pause for a second. To come up with a top priority, right, there's always a few things that come to mind. I'm trying to separate in my head the dealing with the contaminant load, which is significant, as well as a hydrological regime, which is affecting some of the sensitive areas of the wetland, for example. So the way the Fong Marina works is it's a raised bog. So you get the bog system is actually higher in the swamps. And naturally, one of the key water sources for the wetland wasn't Lake Waikato, it was actually the Waikato itself. And the Waikato would love to have that water in the wetlands. It's so much better condition. And so the actual ecological health of the place would be very different if it's the water during floods was pushing in from the Waikato. It would actually be probably more thriving as a system. So one of the challenges is that dealing with a system that has turned around completely where it's getting its water from, because it's turned around and all those little subcatchments above the wetland are highly degraded, you get a much more sort of like concentration of contaminants within the wetland system. So the other thing if you're asking me, is to find a way for the contaminated water not to deposit in the wetland. Is there another option for flood management to enable that place? But that's a very big economic question.
Yes. You've heard it. No doubt heard that there's some appellants are very keen for the wetland to have its own FMU associated with it. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, in my evidence I talked about it for a few paragraphs, and it also came up as a topic during the wetlands expert conferencing as well. Just two comments probably quickly from a technical perspective. There was agreement with Dr. Scarsbrook and Mr. Cleve, the Tushing Game expert present, that there is technical, from a technical perspective, the concept of FMU can be supported. is actually his guidance. MFE has guidance on the establishment of FMUs, and it goes through a series of criteria, looking at hydrological functioning and so forth, spatial context, and similar objectives. And for me, when I look at those criteria, there is existing with the catchment management plan. It's clearly hydrologically connected because all those sub-catchments all come into the Whangarei River and Island Lock Road. They've got clear objective consistency because there's a specific objective in PC1 about Whangarei. So that, I guess when I worked through the criteria that the MFE established in the 2016 guidance, I was almost surprised that there isn't an FMU proposed for Whangarei. What was the basis for not establishing one, given that there's clear guidance? Maybe it came out later, the guidance, perhaps, getting the process kicked off. From a stepping away from that, my view is that integrated management is absolutely critical. And so, while there may be suggestions that the plan enables integrated management in the way that FMUs are constructed, I think having all those sub-catchments organised under an FMU will enhance the monitoring and reporting of progress under the plan to achieving its outcomes. Because you need all those sub-catchments to be achieving their goals, to achieve the goals of the outstanding water body. So why have them all sort of looking at the river when actually before it gets to the river, that water needs to improve its bottom marina. So the overall Lower Waikato as an FMU is still important, absolutely. But you need to almost achieve the outstanding water benefit as an FMU result before you worry about the Lower Waikato as an FMU, because there's big enough challenges there. So as an integrated management approach, and given the critical urgency that I think there is, I don't see why we wouldn't.
Yeah, and one sort of last question, sort of wrapping those ideas up, I ask you to sort of talk about what you could have if you had another constraints. So in terms of plan change one, there's another plan change coming at the end of next year. Plan change one is you've got a short time frame associated with it. It's got short term targets in it. What in terms of wetlands in general and presumably in particular the Whangarei, do you see is the best thing that Plan Change 1 can do for wetlands and for Whangarei?
I think Whangarei, from what my evidence, has the two things which we've talked about a little is much clearer implementation method for Whangarei to require some action to work towards an integrated approach to achieving the water quality objectives. So suggesting of implementing a catchment management plan, but that's as far as it goes. There's no time frame, there's no specifics. And maybe that comes later, it's not the position of the plan to go into that level of detail, but it's still being recommended. So that's I guess the problem we know. Well, I think the FMU will go towards that as well. For wetlands generally, I do think these setbacks at 10 metres are critical. There is no evidence that strongly backs up the 3 metres as a way to effectively manage contaminants. There is evidence at 10 metres, and we saw in Ms. McCarthy's evidence of these of the curves that have been talked about. One thing to note there, and the suggestions are, like, it looks like most of the benefits are 5 metres for sediment reduction. But what wasn't asked about, what is the benefit for nitrogen management and phosphorus management? Because obviously there's other forms, not just the sediment of phosphorus too. That same work by Zwang, and also reported in the Fenimore paper, the reason they landed on 10 metres wasn't necessarily just for the sediment. It was because actually the benefit where the curve started to flatten out for nitrogen and phosphorus was bigger. The sediment curve started to flat out early, when the nitrogen and phosphorus curves, they flatten out later. That's why 10 metres is required. If you're just looking at sediment management, then you can maybe start debating about that 10 metres. So, if you want to manage contaminants into wetlands, you need effective setbacks. And I don't see any evidence that suggests that Three Rivers does that, and I didn't see the council present that evidence.
Like, listening to your answer just reminded me of another word which you've mentioned quite often. It's critical. It's a pretty big word. But to me, when I hear critical, it's drop everything and do something about it. Is that really what you mean?
Perhaps I use it too much, so apologies for that. Do I use all my evidence, or just as I speak now, perhaps?
Yes, you've used it several times in speaking. I can't remember whether you used it. I didn't count it for that word.
I guess there are certain things that are more critical than others, folks, and I should be mindful of those. I guess you've asked me towards the end, was most important for wetlands and the setbacks of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just have one follow-up question on the board, and it really relates to the 50 square metre to 500 square metre wetlands. And at this stage, we don't know how many there are, we don't know what condition they're in, we don't know what the benefits will be for treating any particular wetland. So one of the things I'm struggling with is the cases of a blanket requirement that all 50 square metre wetland should be fenced, because that may not get the results that you're looking for. So that's causing me a problem at the moment with putting in any blanket requirements at this stage. If we are to take a staged approach, you mentioned fen-type wetlands. Are there any particular wetlands that you can say, now these are going to be really important, critical, can you give us some guidance on that, as to where you would set your priorities, given the limited knowledge we know about the benefits we'll get from doing certain things? Because it's not just fencing, you may have to restore them and things like this. We're talking about an area where we don't know how much it's going to cost to achieve what. So where would you put your dollar at the moment?
When you just introduced that as well, just comment quickly of not knowing the benefit of 50 square metres. I probably have a bit of a different take on that, because the benefit of the setbacks around wetlands at 500 square metres are equivalent to the setbacks of a wetland at 100 metres square or 250 metres square. And there is evidence of, with increased contamination of things like nutrients, you get changes in plant composition with exotic species, such as Phalaris, Brandacea species in New Zealand. That is just the nature of these plant species that they do very well in becoming dominant in more high nutrient environments. And so, as in lake systems, you get algal blooms, for example, with unbalanced water quality or altered water quality. The benefit is to maintain the condition of the wetlands and not to favour a shift towards a degraded state dominated by
the
species. So I guess I'm just thinking that benefit is, for me, applies at 500 metres that it does at 4. Because I've now done that, I've got a question.
How do we?
So
the dollar's going to be spent, how do we make sure it's wisely spent and not on a wetland that's degraded or too far gone to be worth saving in the short term?
It does, of course, depend on the context of the catchment. But there are some wetland types that are rain-fed wetland systems. And the Waikato includes these.
Mm-hmm.
There are the Hoopong trophic when they're rain-fed. And our bog systems are often rain-fed systems, and they don't get direct inputs of water from surface inflows. Therefore, unless those surface inflows have been changed, and you can get some bogs which are getting influenced if the drain's been built into them. Those systems, even if you can be farming near to the bog, and it may be just things like nitrogen drift or other things like that that may be affecting them through more atmospheric routes. There's no strong information I have on that, but the connection of the water may not be as clear. However, there's not many of those bog systems remaining, and most of them are large in scale. So there may not be much opportunity there with regards to those. The other wetland types, however, are susceptible to degradation.
So, coming back to the fen system, would you say that's something that needs to be protected?
You look at, the different significance of wetlands within the Waikato region, and then those that are more highly depleted or much more rare than other types. You still want to hold on to those systems because of their rarity and manage any pressures on them. But also on the policy, maintaining all wetlands which require management as much as possible. But in practical terms, there may have to be some prioritisation.
Here we are, actually helping in deciding what that should be. Okay, but that's fair enough. It's obvious that it's very difficult to do, and that answers the question anyway. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I've just got one topic of terminology, which you may tell me is not material for the purposes of Plan Change 1, and if you think that, then you should say so. Paragraph 45, you describe Tongariro, and you say it's got so much bog habitat, so much fen habitat, so much marsh habitat, so much swamp habitat. And I would have seen those four terms as being synonyms. But obviously you've said on various occasions you've talked about a fen or a bog. I take it there are objective markers of those four habitats that enable you to distinguish between them.
If you go to the last page, what you've done, the appendix 2.
Oh,
I didn't probably have a reference at that paragraph.
No, sorry. Okay, well, yes. Well, thank you. I'll look at that.
And so there are bogs, for example, as I was thinking about, typically rain-fed, very low nutrient status because they're not getting those inputs as far as we're.
Well, that helps me. I was thinking about going back to the statutory definition, and I realised that it starts with the word includes. It doesn't have a means and then includes. It starts with includes. And the only other definition I can find that does that is the definition of environment, which covers everything. I'm not sure that wetland covers everything. Is that statutory definition in the RMA includes, or leave up the includes, permanently or intermittently wet areas, shallow water and land water margins that support a natural ecosystem of plants and animals that are adapted to wet conditions? In your opinion, as an expert in this field, is that a satisfactory definition?
Topic of much conversation and many different processes.
Yeah.
My personal reading of it is you do get into, for example, when I tried at the start to talk about the boundaries of lakes, because you can have permanently wet lake systems, and how do they differentiate from the ways those words are written. There is a definition of lake in the RMA as well, but that doesn't help
you
much further either.
No. It's a little bit like what we've heard about the difference between intermittent and ephemeral streams. There's no clear break point, is there?
And there is always, ecology is on a continuum,
right.
But nonetheless, I feel that some further clarification may be useful.
Thank you. Is there anything arising under court questions? No. Thank you very much for your evidence. Do we have one more witness in person, or are we moving to the...
I'm moving to the ABL soon.
All right.
Three witnesses on ABL.
Right. And are we in a position to start that this afternoon?
We certainly have got Stuart standing by and ready to go.
Right. So we'll take the afternoon break now and allow a bit of setting up to go. Can I just, Mr. Conway, do you have any questions for these witnesses to come?
Not many, sir. We're looking to be pretty efficient.
No? All right. I just note that many others have not been cross-examining the Director General's witnesses. Is there anyone who would the next three witnesses is likely to take much time. May well be that again, because it's only the small groups of us, we should just do that to be safe.